connection.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And so it begins, not as predicted with shock and awe, but with questions about an early morning air raid in Baghdad and expectations of much more to come. After uncertain reports of explosions in the southern part of the Iraqi capital, President Bush announces that select military targets have been struck and that military action has begun to end what he calls an outlaw regime threatening the peace of the world.
We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities.
The first attack in Baghdad is being described as an attempted decapitation strike aimed at Saddam Hussein and his senior military command. Soon after, Saddam Hussein himself was on television, taunting America and telling the world that it is being misled by President Bush.
The insane Bush did not care about your cause for peace, and he started a war against Iraq.
There has been limited military activity since that one attack. As many as four Iraqi missiles were launched towards troops in the desert, one aimed at Kuwait City. Some fell short. One was reported to have been intercepted by a new generation of U.S. Patriot missiles. There is no word of any injuries. This hour, Connection listeners, we will have news from the region and analysis. We also welcome your calls. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio now by Graham Allison, director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Studies, and by retired Air Force General Tad Olstrom, director of the National Security Program at the J.F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. We'll be speaking with both guests in just a few minutes. First, though, to Pamela Hess. Pamela is the UPI, United Press International Pentagon correspondent. She's joining us from the Pentagon. Hi, Pamela.
Good morning.
Lots of reports this morning about the what it was that led to the single strike yesterday. What's the latest that you're hearing?
The CIA is sort of talking on background a little bit about this. They confirmed last night that they got some last-minute intelligence that there was, quote, senior Iraqi leadership that had just entered a residence in Baghdad. And this seems to have pushed up the timetable for the start of military action. It caught all of us, actually, by surprise. Most of the people that we sort of look to for information and all the indications were that we're here last night. Folks were clearing out at around 7 p.m. and everyone said tonight's a good night to get your laundry done before things really get started. So this popped up, I think, and caught a lot of people by surprise.
Now, is anyone at the Pentagon saying what they know about what they hid and whether or not there was, the success of that particular
strike?
Right.
It's called battle damage assessment, and they haven't revealed it yet. I think everyone doesn't want to get out in front of the defense secretary, who will be addressing the press corps and, I guess, the nation if it tunes in at 11 o'clock.
And what do we know, Pamela, about how this one particular strike may have changed the original plans? In explaining this, are they saying anything else about what the shock and awe was meant to have been?
I still think you're going to see your shock and awe. They have 3,000 precision-guided munitions all stored up and ready to go. Most of them are going to be joint direct attack munitions, which are 2,000-pound bombs that have tail kits and GPS guidance on them. They're actually pretty cheap. They cost about $30,000 each. Some of the other 3,000 munitions are going to be Tomahawk cruise missiles. We saw 40 of them last night. Just because it didn't happen last night doesn't mean it's not going to happen. Last night was what they call a target of opportunity, and they didn't want to miss their chance. I would also add that the British Defense Minister, Jeff Hoon, said that the senior Iraqi leadership that was targeted were known to be or thought to be in charge of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. No one is confirming that Saddam Hussein was among the group, but there's certainly been some newspaper reports to that effect.
And we're expecting to hear more later in the day then. Thank you very much for your time, Pamela.
Sure thing.
Pamela Hess, UPI Pentagon correspondent, joining us from the Pentagon. And as I mentioned earlier, Graham Allison's with me in the studio, along with Tad Olstrom. And General Olstrom, just the idea that the people in charge of making military decisions would have the capacity to change their minds like that. What does that tell us about the preparations for this particular war?
We've been promised by the Pentagon through numerous briefings that we will see a leap in technology difference between what we saw in Desert Storm. This attack would never have occurred during Desert Storm in the same fashion. We've been able to now take information at a very short notice, be able to program it with simple coordinates that can be used through our GPS systems, and using those JDAM bombs, Joint Direct Attack Munitions, you can actually program them very quickly in the air by getting a message to a pilot. The reaction time is cut down immensely. Likewise, for our cruise missiles that were dependent upon a terrain-following system, a navigation system, that took hours to do programming, in some cases days, can now be done in as simple a fashion using GPS coordinates, and they can also be launched at very short notice.
And Graham Allison, the decision, the political part of the decision to take advantage of that intelligence that Pamela described as coming from the director of the CIA, what do you see in that?
Well, I think that's the bigger leap forward in this. I think Tad's right that the technology allows coordinates early, but I think this reflects Bush's regret for having not acted quickly in the war against Afghanistan, when there were reports from CIA that Osama bin Laden was located at a particular site, and there was a 10-hour decision delay as opposed to an hour or two. In this instance, what appears to have happened is CIA got some information that a group was meeting at a particular location, perhaps to include Saddam. The president met very quickly with the director of CIA and a small group, including Condi Rice, the national security advisor, decided to pull the trigger, even though this, in effect, stepped on the big air war that was planned forward. And somebody whom I spoke to this morning, who's part of the planning for the big shock and awe, was not he was somewhat surprised by the fact that this had occurred in advance of the first wave and in effect, muddied the picture slightly, but I suspect that the spectacular show that we've been promised will come soon.
And I mean, we are seeing wire reports this morning already that in capital cities around the world, tens of thousands of people are marching against U.S. embassies just to express their displeasure. And I bring that up because, again, it points to the uncertainty, the unhappiness about this around the world. I can only imagine that President Bush and his closest advisors, thinking that they might in fact be able to circumvent an entire war with a single strike, would also be taking advantage of that opportunity for that reason?
Absolutely. If you imagine that this had been successful, and we yet to hear, though I think the tape of Saddam that gave particular information about the day, unless it was one of his doubles, is evidence that he probably survived. But in any case, imagine it, a decapitation attack had succeeded in killing Saddam and the leadership, and therefore the war could have been, in effect, avoided.
I wonder if I can go to Cameron Barr of the Christian Science Monitor, who's joining us now from Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. Cameron, you're in a town which is controlled by Kurds, north of Saddam Hussein's control. Are you seeing business as usual? What's the reaction to the overnight news?
The reaction is pretty much that it seems to be the beginning of a dream come true for Kurds. I was just down in what is really the front line here, the town of Cham Chamal, which is on the line that separates Iraq under Saddam Hussein's control versus Iraq under Kurdish control. And that town is completely empty of its civilians, but it's gradually filling up with Kurdish fighters. And they really see the beginning of the end, especially this impression began with the ultimatum 2 days ago. But the first use of military power against Iraq by the United States seems to have convinced them that the Americans really will move against the regime.
We've also been hearing reports, all of them unconfirmed, that there are many Iraqi soldiers in the north ready to, willing to, or perhaps already defecting. Can you give us any help on that, Cameron?
Lots of rumors to that effect, especially in places like Cham Chamal, but it's hard to pin them down. You know, we've heard persistent reports from that place of I've heard it said that two men and another version, seven men, ran down the hill from the Iraqi emplacements that are clearly visible from the Kurdish side and were shot or captured or some escaped. But, you know, when you try to actually find these guys or find someone who actually saw this happen, you know, it's impossible. So right now it's sort of in the land of the unconfirmable.
Now, there are also stories, and you know them well, about the possibility or the likelihood of Turkish troops coming into northern Iraq should an attack actually begin. So when you see the Peshmerga, the Kurdish soldiers gathering, are they facing south or are they facing north?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The Kurdish soldiers who you say are gathering in Chamchamal, are they concerned about Turkish soldiers coming in from the north, or are they focused only on what's happening in Baghdad?
Well, there has been a pressure drop on the Kurdish side, with the Kurds, with the Turks refusing to allow the Americans in Northern Front. The Kurds now believe that the Americans will not now allow Turks to come into northern Iraq. I don't think that we're in the end game of that discussion yet, but I do know that Kurdish officials, especially on this side of northern Iraq, are much more relaxed today about this issue than they were 2 weeks ago. And, you know, the Kurds are playing a very delicate game here. The Americans have asked them not to enter into the big cities of the north, Kirkuk and Mosul, and yet there's clearly a strong incentive for them to do so. And so there's a lot of iteration of the party line that they won't enter those cities. But at the same time, a lot of these Peshmerga, these Kurdish fighters, are from Kirkuk. In some cases, they're from Mosul. They want to help refugees who've been pushed out of those cities by the Iraqi government now to go back. And there's also some political factors at play, where the two Kurdish parties will want to vie for dominance in those cities. And that'll create another motive for the Kurds to move in. And they say in coordination with the Americans, but the possibility for stuff to go wrong here in terms of revenge killing and tensions between Kurds and Turkmens and Arabs, you know, are really pretty high.
Cameron, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Cameron Barr is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. He's reporting now from Sulaymaniyah. And we have just a minute or so before we have to take a break. General Ostrom, the fluid nature of the place where he is, the Kurdish soldiers saying that they're on side, but maybe they're not. Is this a danger zone that you mark as a military analyst?
I think as a military analyst, you must mark it. You must keep a close eye on it. If indeed we were to have U.S. forces in any significant number in that particular area, my suspicion would be is that they would be keeping a very close watch on that as well. The onus now is on the very few special operations forces that we have there in order to monitor that situation, and hopefully we can get it before it becomes a big problem.
And we do know, based on a report earlier today, that of a special forces helicopter crash in which nobody was injured, but in southern Iraq, that the special forces are in place and moving into place. We'll talk further about the north and the south and the capital city, Baghdad, as we continue our coverage of the war in Iraq. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we invite you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by TechFuture.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We are watching the developments in the Gulf on a number of different fronts this hour, monitoring the news out of Kuwait City, also the latest from the Pentagon, the latest from Baghdad, and also northern Iraq, which is actually where we left prior to the break. With me in the studio, Tad Olstrom. He's director of the National Security Program at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. Graham Allison is director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Studies. And Graham, perhaps I should get your thoughts on the nature of the Turkish part of this story. You were saying this is something that's not necessarily getting the amount of attention that it should be getting.
I think that if we said, what's the most surprising feature so far for me in the whole run-up, I think it's the Turkish piece. Turkey is a country that's most dependent on the U.S., in which the U.S. has actually been their best and closest ally in the world, a member of the NATO alliance. And up until today, Turkey is the only member of the NATO alliance, not France, nobody else, who's denying the U.S. the right to overfly Turkey in the case of war. Now, that's coming up for a piece of legislation, I understand, in Turkey today, but it's a very limited piece of legislation which does two things. One, it allows the U.S. to overfly Turkey, not to use even the Turkish bases from which we've been flying Northern Watch, the no-fly zone earlier, mm-hmm. and not to allow U.S. forces to move through Turkish bases into Iraq, which had been planned before. It's a remarkable fact that they would have rejected that and $30 billion, of which six was real money and the rest was loans, on the table.
But are you saying it's remarkable because of the way it changes the relationship between the USA and Turkey, or are you saying that it also may have significant impacts on the way the war in Iraq plays out?
I think both. I think in the first instance, to imagine an ally that's that close and that dependent defying the U.S., under such pressure and with $30 billion on the table, I mean, how can this happen? It really is a shocker. And I think it reflects the democratization of Turkey to some considerable extent, where four out of five people think this war is a mistake. It reflects a new government trying to come to power, including a new prime minister from an Islamic background. So there's lots of complexities in that. With respect to the war itself, I think that we're going to see Turkey moving into Iraq. I think if they don't, I would be shocked. So the comments from Cameron saying that the Kurds feel a little bit more comfortable, I think earlier they thought we were going to let the Turks go right to Kirkuk, that there was going to be a deal. But I think we'll see the Turks moving in to Iraq to protect their interest in the region, and we don't have some basis for denying that.
We actually have on the line with us Johnny Diamond, who's the BBC's correspondent based in Turkey. And Johnny, I gather you're in the southeastern Kurdish city of Diyarbakir at this hour.
That's right. I'm with a very large number of other journalists down here waiting to see what happens on the border. I couldn't agree more with the previous contributor. I think that the Turkish parliament shocked itself by voting down the package and the authorization for troop deployment. It's now in closed session debating the question of airspace rights. Even that very limited contribution towards the U.S. war effort is controversial here in Turkey. Your contributor talked about four out of five people opposing the war. Well, the last opinion poll I saw had 94% of people opposing the war, and frankly, that was an underestimate. I cannot tell you about the hostility there is towards the war and perhaps the way it's changed the relationship with America. America was perceived, I think, up till 2-3 years ago as a close friend of Turkey by the general population. That has changed. There has been a lot of ugly characterization of the U.S. as a bully, as someone trying to bribe its way into Turkey, as someone putting immense pressure on Turkey, pressure which in the end failed, partly perhaps due to some slightly clumsy negotiating tactics on the American side, but largely, I think, because the government mishandled the negotiations and also, crucially, mishandled and underestimated Parliament.
What do we know about the vote, Johnny? And is it your guess at this point that the Turkish parliamentarians may, in fact, grant the United States at least the right to fly over the country?
I think they will. I think they will, primarily because it is such a limited gesture and because of the impact of them being the only NATO partner who has so far refused to grant airspace rights. I think that they will grant that right. It has to be said, I, along with every other journalist and commentator, called the first vote wrong. That vote failed by 3 votes to get through. So nothing is now taken for granted. And as I say, the hostility towards the war, both in the general population and in the parliament, is very high indeed. But with the war now as something of a fait accompli, obviously, I think they will grant airspace rights, rights which I know both the U.S. and the United Kingdom are extremely keen to have.
Johnny, this is Graham Allison, the commenter earlier. If I could ask a question. My understanding that the legislative proposition that they put before the Parliament was not only that it was a linked one in which the U.S. was going to be given the right to overfly on the one hand, but on the other hand, Turkish troops were going to be authorized to move into northern Iraq in order to protect against the flood of refugees, I thought, as was expressed. Is that correct?
That's right. It is a linked motion, and it's certainly true that there is virtually nobody in the Parliament that will oppose the authorization to deploy Turkish troops. That has two objectives, that authorization. One, as you say, to try and control an anticipated flow of refugees. It's difficult to call how many refugees there'll be. But remember, during the first Gulf War, there were 500,000 who turned up on Turkey's doorstep, much to Turkey's discomfiture. But the second, a very important point, politically, strategically, as far as the region is concerned, is this point about Turkey going into northern Iraq to protect what you call its own interests, and what the United States is very, very unhappy about, with a potential clash with the Kurds. There's no love lost between Turkey and the Kurdish-controlled administration in northern Iraq. Turkey is very concerned about either the Kurds making a move on the very oil-rich fields area of Mosul and Kirkuk.
Johnny, it's Dick Gordon here. Just one quick question before I let you go. The fact that you and so many other journalists have gone to that southern Kurdish capital of Diyarbakir to watch what happens, is it your guess that there is going to be a rapid move of Turkish forces south, regardless of whatever vote, however the vote goes?
The vote will give them the authorization, and I think Turkish troops will enter northern Iraq. The question is how many and how far.
Johnny, thanks so much for being with us. Johnny Diamond, correspondent for the BBC based in Turkey. Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We have heard a couple of unconfirmed reports just coming across the wires now that there are more missiles that have been fired into southern Iraq. We know nothing more than that. As soon as we have more information, we'll be bringing that to you. As I mentioned, I have Graham Allison in the studio with me. He's director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Studies, and retired General Ted Ostrom, director of the National Security Program at the JFK School, is also with us. And General Ostrom, I want to go back, if I can, to where we began the program, and that is the speech that the president made last night, because one of the features of it that has received some attention is his own prediction, and in fact, kind of the first from him, that he says a campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict. Is that the president taking a bit of advice from somebody? What's your sense there?
I don't think he's taken advice from anybody. I suspect it's been a broad discussion on how to categorize this war to the American public and to the world. And in my mind, it was probably a necessary thing to do to make sure people understand, even though we've advertised the shock and awe and the rapidity of which we will apply force, the reality is that there are so many unknowns, and there may very well be unknowns out there that will necessitate this thing to go on longer than what people expect.
You've been involved in this sort of military planning. When you look at all those unknowns in this particular conflict, are you looking at a situation where really so many things could change at the last minute that it is difficult to know whether or not, you know, a war in Iraq would last a week or a month or longer?
Absolutely. And one of those huge issues that still stick out there is, what will we do when we get to Baghdad relative to potential urban warfare? What will we do when we do get to Baghdad and we still have not formed confidence that the leadership indeed has been isolated and or taken out? Those are the things that might very well extend this war much longer. And certainly the conversation to follow up the one that we just had on Turkey. What will this do to the length of the war if we have to be able to separate warring factions?
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Fox Lake, Illinois. Ken's on the line. Hi, Ken.
How you doing, Dick?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
I have to say thank you very much for letting me call. And this is a great program. I've been listening to it for as long as I could and can. My question is going to change gears here. I was in the Marine Corps for a number of years, and I served in the Gulf War. And even before serving in the military, I remember learning about the Geneva Convention, and that basically told me, and what it taught me was that in a wartime situation, no country can go after a political leader. Like, another country couldn't go after George Bush and target him specifically and try to knock him off, and we couldn't go after supposedly Saddam Hussein through this Geneva Convention. Now, is there a written bylaw to get around this in this case, or is that Geneva Convention still standing, and why are we able to go after Saddam Hussein in this manner that we are?
Okay, Ken, good question. I'll have Graham Allison answer it.
I think there's two points, Ken, as best I understand it. I do not believe there's anything in the Geneva Convention that prevents, in wartime, when the war has been declared, one country attempting to decapitate and kill the leadership of another country. That's actually what we tried to do through World War II, as you recall, with Hitler, and which we've tried to do in a number of other instances. I think probably what you're remembering is the ban, the presidential ban, and then even a legislative congressional ban on assassination of leadership earlier. And that ban, which still holds in terms of the U.S. legislation, has been reinterpreted by the Bush administration to permit the targeting of Osama bin Laden in the first instance, or Sheikh Omar in the case of Afghanistan, in interpretation that says that if these are combatants or are hostile actors, that an attack upon them as part of an overall U.S. effort to make to engage in conflict or war with leadership or terrorists is permitted. And so the CIA has, on that basis, been acting initially in the Clinton administration and more recently in the Bush administration to target individuals.
All right. Ken, thanks for that call. Let's go straight to Raleigh, North Carolina, and Pat's joining us. Hello, Pat.
Good morning. Thank you for thank you for the show. It's a well done, excellent panel. My question, I think, dovetails with your previous callers. The two aspects of this conflict that the Bush administration and I think the media have really emphasized is the fact that this is a war against the Iraqi regime and not against the Iraqi people, mm-hmm. and additionally that almost all command and control decisions are made at the very top by Saddam or his sons or his close lieutenants. Those things being the case, combined with what the general talked about earlier with the precision of the new munitions and the intelligence that we have, why hasn't there been more consideration given to simply going after, I haven't heard until yesterday any consideration of going after Saddam and his top group and then going mm-hmm. from there, rather than what we've heard about is this shock and approach. What does the panel think about that?
General, what would you say to Pat on this one?
I think my first comment, Pat, would be is as much as our intelligence capacity and capabilities have grown over the years with technology, it indicates to me that we are not that confident that a leader such as Saddam, who is determined to survive, and all the things that he does to keep himself invisible, that we have the sufficient information to use that as our sole focus in a situation like this. Certainly the decapitation of the leadership is part of it, but we also have to convince them in other ways that their leadership will be ineffective when we take their communications down and take their major units away from them.
One of my friends asked the other day, how could we look for 9 months for a young girl in Salt Lake City, 3.5 miles away from her house, and be unable to find her?
Let's go, if we can, to Kuwait City. We have Terry, is that you on the phone?
Yes, I'm here.
Terry McCarthy is joining us. Terry's with Time Magazine, and I understand, Terry, that they've just blown an all clear in Kuwait City. What does that mean?
Well, we had another alert about 20 minutes ago now, and then about 5 minutes ago we got the all clear. That could mean one of two things. It could mean that there was no missile attack in the first place, or it could mean that there, something came in and they hit it with a Patriot and they're convinced that there's no further danger, no further immediate danger. So at the moment we're under an all clear again. We've got our masks off.
Several hours ago, there were reports from Kuwait City that people had heard an explosion. The sirens were blowing at that point, and still there's nothing concrete about specifically what happened. What can you tell us about your day so far?
Well, we've had a total of four alerts today so far. The first one was at 12:30. I think, from what I understand, there have been at least two hits. In other words, two missiles that have exploded on the ground. One of them was outside a marine camp. It didn't do any damage. The other one was closer to Kuwait City. I don't think it actually came inside the city, but that was what people heard in the city, and that was why they set off the alerts again. And, of course, there's a period between when the alerts go off, if nothing explodes or if whatever has happened, they then have to check the atmosphere to ensure there's no chemical or biological agents in the atmosphere, and that's only then do they give the all clear.
Now, for the last couple of weeks, I guess I could say even the last couple of months, reports from Kuwait City have been reports from a city that's just bustling with preparations for war on this morning, the day after that first strike in Baghdad. What do you see in the city? What's different?
Well, a lot of people left the city starting after President Bush's address on Monday. A lot of people left the city heading south to Saudi Arabia. And again, today, when the first air raid siren started, we had a traffic jam on the main north-south highway heading towards Saudi Arabia. So a lot of people are leaving. Even though people have lived with this threat of war for several months here now, there's actually very few people who are equipped to protect themselves against any biochem attack. I think this country has 200,000 gas masks for a population of 2.4 million. So in a sense, there's been a lack of the necessary equipping of the population for that particular threat, which is, of course, what people are so worried about. However, we haven't seen any real panic today, just a lot of nervous people. There hasn't been any mobbing of any public buildings or any facilities yet. And so far, the people are holding out.
Terry, thanks so much for being with us.
Always happy to talk to you.
Terry McCarthy joining us from Kuwait City. He's Time Magazine's correspondent working in the region. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. The picture that's coming from Baghdad and surrounding countries is, even at this hour, a confused one. We have as many sources of information coming into this program as we can get for you, as well as top flight analysis. We welcome your calls at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. With me in the studio, Graham Allison, director of Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Studies, and retired Air Force General Tad Olstrom, director of the National Security Program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. And let's go straight back to the lines to Carrboro, North Carolina. Jimmy's joining us. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I was curious, with all this talk of war, if this actually qualifies as a war. I know Congress hasn't declared a war, and some of my very liberal friends have been calling it an invasion. And I'm curious as to where it falls legally.
It's a question that came up in our office as well, Jimmy, because it's notable that in President Bush's speech last night, he never uses the word war. But
right.
General Olstrom, I'm not sure that when he speaks of, I'm just looking for the words here, military operations, that's not in effect the same language. How do you parse that?
I believe it was intentional that he did not use the term a declaration of war. Certainly the president as commander-in-chief, in light of our own sovereignty and in light of his responsibility to protect the security of the United States, and he feels that this is one of those things he must do to provide security for the United States. He has the right to have our troops engage an enemy that has been identified. The other part is this is a continuation, if you would, of UN resolutions that essentially, in legal sense, he believes and the administration believes allows us to increase the use of force and carry out the missions that we're carrying out.
Are we saying then that the choice of words is not one of political interpretation, but one that actually has its roots in international law, in how he's casting this particular conflict now?
Maybe Graham can answer the international law piece a little bit. I'm not so sure I'm familiar enough to get into it.
What do you think, Graham?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of parsing words. I think the New York Times editorial or headline today says Bush declares start of Iraq war. So in English, this is war. I think that Jim's point from that there hasn't been a congressional declaration of war. Actually, there wasn't a congressional declaration of war in Vietnam. So we've kind of given up doing declarations of war for some considerable period of time. And I think in terms of the authority to proceed with this, both the Security Council resolutions up to and including 1441 on the one hand, and the congressional vote that was taken last fall, in which basically people understood that they were voting for war, whatever words were used, I think, is the context for this.
Jimmy, let me come back to you. Does it matter if the word is used?
Well, I think especially when dealing with an international community that rhetoric does matter. It might be one of the most important things, one of the most important tools we have are the words that we use. And obviously the words that we use shape the ideas of what's happening. So if we say that it's a war, it seems different than if, like I say, my friends use the word invasion, and it puts a whole different spin on it.
No, it's an interesting point, and I should perhaps take it the next step, Graham, again with you in terms of the reaction that we're seeing, because France and Germany have been predictably dismissive today, but you can't help but pause and look at the words of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who calls this a big political mistake. The Chinese Foreign Ministry saying this is a violation of the norms of international behavior. This part of the story is not going away.
Yeah. Well, I think that point is absolutely correct, that if you talk to people internationally, and if you look at international public opinion, as was your reporter from Turkey saying, that overwhelmingly 70%, 80%, 90% of people are against this war, whether you call it a war, an invasion, an attack. Now, that means that the U.S. has failed to make our case publicly to the world that war at this point is urgent and necessary. To have come from 1441 in last fall with a unanimous 15-0 vote for disarming Saddam to action now without a second resolution and in the face of public opinion to the contrary is having deep effects on America's ability to mobilize these populations and these governments for cooperative activity that we need elsewhere, for example, in the war on terrorism. So I think that the fact that one will see quite sharp reactions by President Putin, by Chirac, by Schroeder, but also by people, by ordinary people in Turkey, is a reminder for us as Americans, however we feel about the appropriateness of the military action that's now taking place, that it's having big consequences in terms of other things that we care about internationally.
General Alstom, Graham makes the point about the war on terrorism. It's perhaps worth noting that on this day there is a large incursion of American forces back into Afghanistan. I think some 1,000 soldiers involved. I'm not sure. Is the timing of that, you know, connected to what's going on in Iraq? How do we measure that? An accident?
I don't think we can dismiss the fact that the timing is almost exactly aligned with the initiation of a step-up of hostilities in Iraq. However, I think more importantly, what it does send the message that the administration has not forgotten about the war on terrorism, and that if there is an opportunity to do a mission such as being executed in Afghanistan today, which I assume is directed at some opportunities to corral more leadership of al-Qaeda, that we do have the means and we do have the ability to continue the pressure on the war on terrorism at the same time that we are working the issue in Iraq.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Cary, North Carolina. Bill's joining us. Hello, Bill.
Hi. I have a follow-up question to the gentleman who asked about the terminology war versus invasion, et cetera.
Go ahead.
If this is not a war, per se, what does it take to actually define a war? it seems a little odd to me. And under what circumstances, what would it take to have Congress actually declare war, as was the case in World War II? It seems like that is no longer something that's even considered anymore, and that's my question.
I wonder if Congress's response to that would be more one of defense rather than offense. Graham.
I think that first I'll comment that it's very interesting that we've had several callers from North Carolina, and since I come from North Carolina, I approve of this. So great. And I think it's a very good question. I think that when the Senate debate was held last fall and people voted, they had no doubt that they were voting to authorize the president to go to war if that was required. And so I think that the attempt to say, well, it's not a legal war, or it hasn't been appropriately authorized, or let's call it something other than a war, it seems to me if it's plain English, it's a war. People understood that it was going to be a war. People voted for it on that basis. They may have been right. They may have been wrong. But they're not able, I think, to hide.
General Ostrom, I want to hear a bit from you, if I can, on the debate that has swirled around the anticipation of this, because I'm interested in your perspective from the inside. I'm fairly certain at this point that General Tommy Franks, his senior military leaders, and the men and the women on the front line are not preoccupied with these issues that are being discussed on talk shows back home in America, but focused very specifically on their task, on their mission. Can they make that separation? Can they just move the political noise of whatever is in the air aside and focus on what it is that they're there to do?
That is very easy for them to do, and that is to stay focused on their mission. There is so much surrounding the pulling together of this plan, the execution of the plan, ensuring the communications are open, making sure the system is well-oiled so we can work this thing day after day, the so-called pace of the war activity. This is not a distraction to them. This is something that is very clear, very focused, and it's not a problem at all.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to the lines to Wellesley, and Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I have one question. Turkey and the Kurds have been at each other's throats for years. Now that Turkey is going to go with their troops to the Iraqi border, and when this war or conflict is over, what's going to prevent Turkey just cleaning house and getting rid of the Kurds in the east and the southeast of Turkey, because it is a sovereign land and it is another fraction of the Kurds that live in Turkey? And what's going to prevent the Turkish army coming back slaughtering these people?
Well, other than the fact that it's a democracy and the soldiers are supposed to be under some sort of civilian control, are you suggesting that the Turkish government would make that policy? The Turks were under a lot of criticism for their crackdown against the Kurds during the time that Öcalan was leading the PKK. But what about, are you saying now that the soldiers would be acting on their own, Mark?
No, not the soldiers on their own. A policy, because the Kurds have taken a few terrorist acts to Istanbul. They have put bombs inside of trash containers. There's no in the whole country of Turkey, there's no mailboxes because they're afraid of bombs and they're afraid of the Kurdish revolt against Turkey. Now that the government is going through there, the government troops, when they're pulling back, why not clean house?
Well, it's a good and complicated question. I mean, the Kurdish problem has been one of the bedeviling issues for Turkey. As Dick said, this has gone back and forth, but the Turks were at least coming to some form of accommodation, in part because of their aspirations to be closer to Europe. The terrifying question for the Turks right now is that there's a whole substantial population of Kurds in northern Iraq who would like to be an independent Kurdistan. That's one of their deep ambitions. And the Kurds are being restrained by the U.S. in this regard, since the U.S. is trying to hold together a unified Iraq. So the Turks will be acting, I believe, in this instance to try to assure that no new independent Kurdistan emerges in northern Iraq, and that in any case it doesn't succeed in seizing the oil-rich towns of Kirkuk, which the Kurds will be looking at. So I suspect that American special forces will be early on into Kirkuk to the extent that they can feel secure being there in order to make sure that neither Turks nor Kurds show up there and take control. But it's going to be a complicated issue. And one of the most interesting debates that occurred yesterday in the, or day before yesterday in the Turkish parliament was the debate that which the American ambassador said to the Turks, you forfeited the right to go into Iraq by failing to give us the use of the bases. And the Turkish parliamentarian said, by what authority are you allocating the rights to go into Iraq? If you're going into Iraq, why not us?
So much of where we are in trying to make sense of the story now is speculation about what will happen. General Ostrom, I'm thinking of the rumor yesterday that Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz was killed or had defected. The rumor that was pushed forward that Saddam Hussein was in fact killed by this strike, and speculation that the man on television may not in fact have been Saddam Hussein. Cameron Barr was talking about rumors of desertion in northern Iraq. As someone who's seen a lot of this from the inside and the outside, how do you shove aside what you can focus on and what you can't?
I think it's dependent on all of us to remember that as these things are happening, that all information ought to be treated as suspect information. It is terrifically important that we continue to put information out to the best of our ability, and certainly we expect more and more of that to occur in this conflict than what we have seen in the past. But all information should be treated as suspect unless there is adequate proof put in front of our eyes. We can expect much more of this. I think from a military leader's standpoint, they see this question mark a lot more quickly than maybe somebody that is receiving information from multiple media sources in the United States. They are going to question every piece of this, very important, and continue to press on with the focus on the plan.
Well, we will question it here at The Connection, and listeners encourage you to do the same thing. NPR will be keeping you up to date throughout the day with more news from the Gulf. General Ostrom, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
General Tad Ostrom directs the National Security Program at Harvard University's JF Kennedy School of Government. And Graham Allison, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Graham directs Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Studies. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Pamela Hess, UPI's correspondent at the Pentagon, Cameron Barr, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor currently in Sulaymaniyah, and Terry McCarthy of Time magazine in Kuwait, as well as the BBC's Johnny Diamond speaking to us from Diyarbakir in southern Turkey. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Funding.
Up next on WBUR, a Pentagon briefing by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld with NPR's Bob Edwards. That's coming up next at 11 o'clock on WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Gregorian Oriental Rugs, now hosting its annual midwinter event designed to create family heirlooms for today's lifestyle and budgets. Gregorian Oriental Rugs, a little part of Persia in Newton Lower Falls. And Clear Channel Entertainment, presenting Peter Gabriel on June 18th at the Tweeter Center. Tickets available this Saturday through Ticketmaster.com or 617-228.